Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Dr. Alan Butterfield Show because we are joined at the mic from the University of Kentucky, the Alumni Association Endowed Professor of Biological Chemistry, Director of the Center of Membrane Sciences, Director of the Free Radical Biology and Cancer Shared Resources, Dr. Alan Butterfield. Welcome to the program, Alan.
Thank you so much.
And with us as always... I'm trying to think of something insulting to say, Rick, and I'm just running a blank right now. Apply last week's insults from the University of Kentucky, the service owner for telephony and communications, Rick Phillips, to tell us about our electronic presence. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get the audio of the shows at WMKY.org. That's right, WMKY.org. Go there. You can read the short summaries on each show. You can download them. You can listen to them right there on the website. You can sign up for a podcast. There's a lot to do there at WMKY.org, especially if you want to listen to the show. Old copies, what we see is our show airs live, and then about 3 or 4 days later, it shows up on the website and it shows up in the podcast. So certainly find your way to WMKY.org if you want to listen to the show. If you want to interact with the show, go to Facebook.com, do a search for HM Radio Show. There you'll find a page devoted to health matters. You can leave your comments. You can leave your feedback. You can make fun of Tony. We encourage the latter because...
Well, thank you, Rick.
Every once in a while, he just needs to know, right?
Yeah, keep me humble.
And we do use Facebook to interact with our listener. We certainly want to hear what you have to say. We want to know what you're interested in as far as show topics. And then from time to time, we post information that is both on the show and not on the show. So there's a lot to do there at Facebook.com.
Our sponsor for today's show, the Disease of the Month Club. This month's disease, Alzheimer's disease. And their motto, I'm not a hater, I don't like amyloid beta. We'll talk more about amyloid beta later on in the show, but this is our top 10 fun facts about Alzheimer's disease. Fun fact number one, Alzheimer's disease first identified more than 100 years ago. 1906, Dr. Alzheimer noticed changes in the brain tissue of a woman who died of an unusual mental illness. He examined her brain after death and found clumps, now called amyloid plaques, and tangled bundles of fibers, now called neurofibrillary tangles. The fascinating thing, and this guy, obviously either very lucky or more likely extremely bright, these two findings are still much of Alzheimer's research today is on these two things. You know, Rick, I've wondered about having a disease named after you. You got to think about that. I mean, it didn't work out very well.
The proverbial double-edged sword?
Yeah, because, you know, Lou Gehrig, I mean, that didn't work out well at all.
No.
The victim of disease, that's bad. But if you're the person, you know, you bequeath to your family the fact that there's a disease named after them.
Well, what about if they cure something and then you're never mentioned again?
Your disease is gone. I like that.
You're off the books.
Or maybe it gets named after somebody with an easier name.
Can you imagine if Tony Weaver was smallpox?
Yeah.
And it's just gone.
Weaver's disease, and somebody finds a vaccine for it.
And then you're done. They don't talk about you for 100 years.
And you'd have this mixed feeling. You know,
well, it's kind of like what we do here.
Yeah, I feel kind of good that they cured my disease, but now who's going to remember me? What am I famous for? Nothing.
See.
Now, Alan, you got to think about that. If you cure Alzheimer's disease, what will the Alzheimer family think of you? Not something I bet you had not really considered.
I guess that's a question I really have never dealt with
before. And that's what you'll get here in Health Matters.
Fun fact number two, Alzheimer's disease, the sixth leading cause of death in American adults, affects more than 5 million Americans, 8 million more people worldwide. Number three, according to the U.S. Alzheimer's Association, Kentucky has 80,000 people with Alzheimer's disease. That was in 2010. Number four, according to the U.S. Alzheimer's Association, 1 in 8 people over age 65 and 1 in 2 people over age 85 have Alzheimer's disease. That is, as our population ages, as we give ourselves a longer life, there are some ripple effects that we have to account for. And fun fact, number five, age is the primary risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. The number of cases doubles every 5 years for people over 65. And as I mentioned, that includes half the people over age 85.
When you say half... At over age 85, you mean in some form or fashion of, I mean, some maybe moderate? I mean, is there a livable where you can tolerate it at age 86? So you're 86 and you get it. Is there a moderate degree by which?
Oh, yeah. Well, there is a progression. We know about mild cognitive impairment progressing to Alzheimer's disease. And certainly there is that, Rick. But you know, I mean, it is rare to see that person who's in their 90s and living independently. That is a rare thing. There are a lot of people who make it to 95 or 100. But in most cases, due to physical and mental concerns, they wind up living with family or
in a
controlled
environment. Assisted living in some form or fashion.
Yeah, in some way. So it does, certainly it has an effect. It causes people as they get older, you have to rethink your living arrangements and so forth. That's our sponsor, Alzheimer's disease, the disease of the month. And remember, I'm not a hater, but I don't like amyloid beta. Now, Alan, we start the first portion talking about why you do what you do. My first question, I just right off the bat, I got to ask you, did you get a chemistry set when you were in elementary school?
Actually, I did not. I grew up in a rural, small community in Maine in which education and other aspects of development really weren't emphasized. And so, no, I didn't. But I have always been very curious. And luckily, when I was able to go to college at the University of Maine as an undergraduate, chemistry faculty seemed to see something in me and encouraged me to do research with them. And that really opened up the whole idea that you could actually make a living by thinking. Because up until that time, I had paid my way through college through kind of backbreaking work. And I really like it much better to be able to use your head to get ahead, as is.
So relatively, you were a late bloomer then.
Well, in terms of science, I've always been interested in science, but I never had the opportunities when I was a youngster to really explore that much, given the circumstances of the economics of our family and our town.
Rick, I'm guessing you had some kind of electronic circuit board. You probably skipped the chemistry set altogether.
Yeah,
right?
No. I created electrical fires, not chemical fires.
Okay, fair enough. That's a good thing. Next was an unfortunate period in your life when you went to Duke University and got a PhD. We call that your blue devil period.
Here at UK, from a basketball standpoint, we don't think too highly of Duke.
It was tough, but, obviously you must have done very well in your chemistry at Maine because
and
Duke.
Clearly, it's an extremely good research.
What attracted you to Duke?
Well, I intended to go there actually to study quantum mechanics. And because I was pretty good in mathematics and chemistry, physical chemistry, and Duke has had a long history of theoretical excellence in chemistry. And I, in fact, went to join the group of a wonderful theorist who, on the first day I met him, said, well, you could do that, but there is a new technique called spin labeling that my previous theoretical advisor has invented. And he said, I don't know what that is. And it's being applied to something called a cell membrane, and I have no idea what that is. But he said, here we are at Duke, arguably one of the better medical schools in the world. We ought to be able to figure all this out. So he said, you teach me about cell membranes, and I'll teach you magnetic resonance. And that's how my PhD went. And it was highly intellectually stimulating and just great.
But there must have been a moment when you got there at Duke. I mean, I guess I'm sort of projecting myself here, but they say, oh, we've changed your plans. You have to look at that. And the first thing is you're thinking, well, how good is this machine and what does it do?
Well, actually, no, it just sparked a lot of curiosity in me and I was ready to go. And everything that I worked on worked well. I was able to get my PhD in fewer than 3 years. And that's unusual. And it's because the systems that I worked on and the experiments that I did turned out really, really well. And I was able to publish quite a bit as a graduate student, and one thing led to another.
On to postdoctoral work in neurosciences. I guess once you looked at cell membranes, that led you to the nerve membranes?
That's right. One of the members of my PhD committee at the time of the defense was a neurochemist and a neurologist at Duke. And he persuaded me to write an NIH proposal for postdoctoral fellowship, and luckily it was funded. And I was able to learn a lot from him about the nervous system, particularly the peripheral and certainly the central nervous system.
Why did you come to UK?
I came to UK because they had sent out an advertisement for a person who knew electron paramagnetic resonance, which, of course, what spin labeling uses, who knows chemistry real well and can teach physical chemistry, but who does research on biological systems. And I said, my goodness, that's me. And so I applied to this university, and luckily they chose me among many other applicants. And as soon as I got here, I started making collaborations with people in the College of Medicine, and this has been life-changing for me, I must say. The talent pool here at UK among faculty researchers is just enormous. And I was able to interact with a number of such people who have been incredibly helpful to me as my career has moved on.
Now, there are pages of awards here, everything from Honorable Order of Kentucky Colonels to editorial board member of the Journal of Membrane Science. The one that really intrigued me was you were a consultant to NASA, the shuttle experiment panel in 1997. What did that involve?
So they wanted to know whether a series of experiments that were proposed by a contractor, Lockheed Martin, were feasible. And so they wanted outside people to examine those experiments, and a number of them involved membrane systems. And so they asked me to evaluate those along with other members of a panel, and that was kind of interesting to do.
Yeah, I thought you'd use solid fuel propulsion or something like that.
No.
Yeah, or the ion cannon. That's what I want to consult on is that thing.
But he's trying to build one in his backyard.
Yeah, well, you know, you get some free time and you get a couple of pieces of scrap metal and you just see what turns out. You know?
So you had a chemistry set. I had an electrical set. He had the operation game playing doctor.
No, I was actually late for that as well, but late for most everything. This is a question that's really puzzled me, Alan, and I've had ideas before. I've had some that I think are pretty good ideas, but you have devoted your lifetime to this idea. Were there times when you thought maybe this is the wrong idea, that things are not going to work out, or how do you approach your day as a person who's been spending your life studying these membrane interactions?
Well, particularly these membrane interactions related to Alzheimer's disease, and I must say every day that I get up, I'm really looking forward to coming to UK and to work. It's exciting things that we do. All my graduate students and postdocs over the years have had the same kind of enthusiasm. I never have to motivate anybody to do the work. They're all really thrilled to be working on such an important problem. And knowing that whatever they contribute might be just the thing to help people's lives, and we're talking millions of people here, as you mentioned. And so, no, I've never been discouraged, frankly. I really like what I do and pleased that I have the opportunity to do it here at UK.
You know, we're going to be talking more about actually what you do in our second fractional portion. We are talking with Dr. Alan Butterfield, the alumni professor of chemistry and the director of the Center of Membrane Sciences at the University of Kentucky. And we're going to try to understand redox, the amyloid beta protein, a little bit more. And believe me, this is going to be tons of fun. I had so much fun studying this. We'll try to
Can we start with a dictionary?
Yeah.
Explain some of these words?
That will be an excellent way to start this off. But first, we've got to take a break. So why not go drink some refreshing antioxidants, get some sleep, for goodness sakes, because that might help you out as well. And stay tuned for our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is a second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Dr. Alan Butterfield Show because with us from the University of Kentucky, the Alumni Association Endowed Professor of Biological Chemistry and the Director of the Center of Membrane Sciences, Dr. Alan Butterfield. Welcome back, Alan.
Thank you. Good to see you again.
Our sponsor for the second time, the Disease of the Month Club, this month's disease, Alzheimer's disease, reminding you we're beginning to get annoyed with beta amyloid. That's right, beta amyloid, amyloid beta, one of the proteins found in Alzheimer's disease and appears to be one of the agents of Alzheimer's disease that causes the disease. These are our top 10 fun facts about Alzheimer's disease, reminding you from our first fractional portion. It was identified by Dr. Alzheimer over 100 years ago, and at that time, he noticed both the neurofibrillary tangles and the amyloid plaques that are the center of research for Alzheimer's to this day. It is the sixth leading cause of death in America. More than 5 million Americans are affected. It affects 80,000 people in the state of Kentucky. According to the U.S. Alzheimer's Association, 1 in 8 people age 65 and older have it. Age is the primary risk factor. The number of cases of Alzheimer's disease doubles every 5 years in people over age 65, and by age 85, half of all people are afflicted. Now we're up to fun fact number 6. It is exceptional for it to occur before age 60, but 4% of Alzheimer's disease patients are under age 65. Number 7, 1 in 3 seniors dies with this or another dementia. Again, if you live long enough, this will become a problem. Number 8, almost 2/3 of Americans with Alzheimer's are women. Now, Rick, we've talked about this. You know, the men have the stupid gene, and the stupid gene sort of clears you out before you reach retirement age.
Right.
So if you're going to get hit by a tree, if you're going to be involved in some horrible—
You're not going to get hit by a tree. You're going to hit a tree.
Right. If you're going to get involved in some type of a jet ski accident involving a waterfall, probably you're going to be a man.
Something you said, hey, watch this right
yeah.
before it
Hold
happens.
My beer and watch this. That's what men say. Women, on the other hand, more cautious, and that means 2/3 of Americans with Alzheimer's are women. Fun fact number 9, people with the disease survive on the average about half as long as similarly aged adults without the disease. That is an important factor.
Once you get it, your lifespan is half compared to somebody who doesn't.
Right. You're age 65. By that time, your normal life expectancy is going to be up in the 80s, but you're probably going to be in the upper 70s, I guess, if you have Alzheimer's or something like that. Fun fact number 10, in 2012, 15 million caregivers provided 17 billion hours of unpaid care, valued at more than $216 billion. That is the thing. Alzheimer's is not a disease of a single person. It affects an entire family. That's our sponsor, the Disease of the Month Club, Alzheimer's disease. Remember, we're beginning to become annoyed with beta amyloid. Now, first, to understand what Dr. Butterfield does, we've got to talk about oxidative stress. And there are many types of stress. Having Rick on the program is certainly one of them.
This hey, 500 and something shows, and you keep asking me back.
No, we just can't figure out how to change the locks, Rick. There's no invitation here.
Believe me, they don't give you a key either.
All right. Yeah, that's true. We just wander in and find a microphone. But back to oxidative stress. Alan, can you tell us a little bit about oxidative stress, what it involves?
Oxidative stress is the net of free radical production versus free radical scavenging by enzymes or small antioxidants in your body. When the rate of free radical production exceeds the rate of free radical scavenging, then there is an excess of free radicals, and these cause a damage to different tissues, in my case of interest, the brain, and that is said to then exhibit oxidative stress.
So these free radicals, these are small chemicals?
Yes.
See, I keep thinking it's a group.
I know. They sound dangerous, don't you think? I mean,
yeah,
you say free radicals, you think, I don't want
to
mess with
them. They are dangerous.
I don't want to do with them. I don't want to work with
yeah.
them.
So these things, if I understand, tell me if I'm wrong here, but these are things that have a free electron, and they go and they bond with stuff and wreck it.
That is so. Nature abhors molecules with a single electron. Nature always wants electrons to be paired up. And so when a reactive molecule has an unpaired electron, it seeks out another electron from a nearby molecule, like a protein, a lipid, a DNA molecule, abstracts that and damages the resulting moiety.
So these things are going, they're blowing holes in your DNA, your proteins. These are nasty things. Now, obviously, then the next question is, how do we make free radicals?
Well, you make free radicals many ways. Among them, just breathing air. Every time you inspire oxygen and it's used in your cells, in the mitochondria of your cells, there is a small leak of free radicals from the mitochondria in the form of superoxide free radicals that can then cause even more dangerous free radicals to be formed. Also, toxic materials that you may have in you from ingesting bad things can lead to free radicals. And also metal ions, for example, copper, iron, and so forth, can lead to free radical production.
So the big things that we do, and I knew this was a mistake, Rick, is we breathe. I just felt like that was just wrong from the start. I hold my breath as much as I can.
Yeah, you know, I hear you.
Keep myself. But seriously.
Hold it a little longer.
Yeah, so, thanks. But diet is an issue here. If you eat the wrong types of foods, you're going to generate more free radicals.
Correct.
Now, let me ask you about the oxygen, because I am interested in this. Do scuba divers, do astronauts, do you think that that is the time they are diving or the time they're in space, breathing the oxygen, is that a dangerous time for them, or is it regulated such that it's not really an issue?
You know, it's a little bit beyond my expertise, but my guess would be that that could be a concern. But now I can tell you back to a medical condition. Very often, the treatment of choice for a person with stroke is to put 100% oxygen. That has been shown by many people, especially a person at the University of Maryland Medical School, to be pretty dangerous. And he's been advocating to use normal oxygen levels after a stroke rather than 100% oxygen.
You see, that makes perfect sense with the much higher level of oxygen in your bloodstream than you're typically used to breathing. I mean, I've done a little scuba diving, and you know, you're breathing 21% oxygen,
so
just like you're breathing just like you would be today. I mean, now you're at a different altitude, so every time you go deeper in the water, it's like being at a different altitude.
Wow. Okay. So people up in the mountains, people in Colorado.
Absolutely.
Huh. Interesting.
Pilots who spend a lot of time up there, they pressurize to 10,000 feet. So even if you're at 40, your body still is like it's at 10,000. So right. Yes, there is a reduced amount of oxygen.
Now let me say a word for our fans who happen to be on home oxygen. If you were properly diagnosed, you need that oxygen just to keep normal oxygen levels.
Right.
What we're talking about here is the Michael Jackson hyperbaric oxygen,
correct.
The excess,
right.
And specifically, Alan, certainly when a person comes in with a heart attack or stroke, we use oxygen and we're not sure whether that for heart attacks is beneficial or not. Maybe the heart needs it, but there is some concern about that. And there's actually a number of studies nationwide to try to figure out when and how to use oxygen. It should be obvious, but it's not. How do you get rid of free radicals?
So free radicals are scavenged by certain antioxidant enzymes that everyone has, also by low molecular weight free radical scavengers that everyone has or takes in through their diet. And these molecules are very efficient at scavenging free radicals and trying to prevent their damage to cellular components.
Please tell me those are found in dark chocolate.
They are.
So I can eat some.
Absolutely. And not milk chocolate. Dark chocolate. Absolutely.
In dark chocolate. Unfortunately, they're found in a bunch of other healthy foods, and that's going to really going to sink it for me.
Apples,
for example. Yeah. Again, one of the reasons why healthy foods are healthy is they seem to scavenge to pull away these free radicals. And there is a group of people who feel that free radicals are the key to aging. This is an old theory, but one we were just talking before the show at Vanderbilt, the physiology department was convinced that that was the key to everything. And so they were actually working on both diet and supplements that would scavenge free radicals. So we've got the free radicals. Now, talk to me about proteomics and redox proteomics. Tell me what that is.
So probably everyone has heard of the term genomics and the Human Genome Project, in which the DNA were identified for every human, or can be for every human. Well, remember, genes don't do the work of cells. Proteins do. So it's really important to understand the proteins that are in your cells. And the way one identifies an unknown set of proteins is a technique called proteomics. This has several steps involved, but ultimately involves the use of a high-resolution technique like mass spectrometry to identify the particular proteins. Now, in what our laboratory pioneered was the use of redox proteomics, was to identify in brain, but also in other tissues, those proteins that are specifically oxidized over the same protein in a control sample. And we were able to develop this method. It's now widely used in neurological disorders, particularly Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and Huntington's and so forth.
So you think the damage of Alzheimer's disease can at least in part or mostly, I guess, be explained by oxidation from these free radicals?
Oh, absolutely. So in 1994, we published the first paper to show that amyloid beta peptide that accumulates in the brains of people with Alzheimer's itself can be associated with free radicals and cause lipid peroxidation, protein oxidation, DNA oxidation, cell death, and so forth. So this changed the paradigm of thinking of Alzheimer's disease to now include oxidative stress as a major risk factor, if not an initial event in the progression of this disease.
And this oxidative stress affecting, I guess, acting through this amyloid beta protein is what causes the nerve damage for Alzheimer's disease.
That's so. But unlike plaques are a pathological hallmark of the disease. It's a small aggregate of this amyloid beta peptide, perhaps dimer, tetramer, hexamer, some small number called an oligomer that is the toxic species of this protein or this peptide. And it is that agent that does engender free radical production and cause such horrible damage to the nerve, and especially to the synapse. The presynaptic terminal is really, really damaged by amyloid beta peptide.
So you got this amyloid beta peptide. First of all, I got to tell you how far this has come, Rick. Maybe I just didn't pay attention in class in medical school. But when I was in medical school, the impression I got was the neurofibrillary tangles, the amyloid plaques, these were like scars. You know, this is how you knew you had Alzheimer's disease, because you had these scars. And it turns out there are groups of people right now that feel that each of these things is actually doing the damage. And again, as you mentioned, not the plaque itself, which is just a byproduct. Yeah, it's a byproduct. But they're bits and pieces, smaller proteins, that actually move up and down the nerves, rip the things open, and where the nerves connect the synapses, all hell breaks loose.
Absolutely right. So you can see in model systems, in animal systems, and if you're lucky, in human systems, using a special technique, you can see the non-function, the dysfunction of the synaptic region of cells, of neurons. And that becomes very clear why you can have loss of memory, loss of reasoning, loss of cognitive function altogether. When the synapse goes, that's sort of the end of the game.
Now, we've talked about limiting, again, oxidative stress using it's pretty much what we've talked about, the Mediterranean diet. Fruits, nuts, things like that turn out to be really good at limiting oxidative stress. But the other thing, I guess, is can we limit the amount of this amyloid beta protein that's made?
the way this peptide is made is by the action of two enzymes called proteases that cleave a very large protein called amyloid precursor protein. And as a consequence, pharmaceutical companies are working hard to try to inhibit one or both of these proteases to prevent A-beta from being formed. And so that's the best approach from many pharmaceutical companies' points of view. Others are thinking of things like vaccinations to try to prevent A-beta from being damaging. Our laboratory's approach is to say A-beta is going to form. How can you prevent it from doing its damage? And that's where we use small molecule antioxidants and other approaches to prevent these damage, which we certainly have done in the mice who have this human A-beta being overproduced. We can completely protect the brain of those mice.
So they have the amyloid beta, but it doesn't seem to be causing harm to these mice if you treat them.
That's right. What we did was to raise the body's own endogenous antioxidant system. In the brain, the largest percentage of antioxidants that you have is a molecule called glutathione. And so we were able to make the mouse raise its own glutathione level, even though it had a huge amount of this human A-beta being produced. The free radical damage in that brain was essentially equal to that of a control mouse.
So you've got amyloid beta. You've got these free radicals. Again, they oxidize. The amyloid beta is the agent that then causes the damage to the nerve. I've got to ask you, and obviously this was not the best day in your career when the information came out on vitamin E and antioxidants. It would seem then that there's a very simple way to prevent Alzheimer's disease in people, and that is to give them vitamin E and other antioxidants. We know that did not work. And I wondered your thoughts, first of all, how you responded to that, because that's one of those days that I would go back and I would think, okay, you know, I could have been a very successful accountant or something like that. But what do you think about that? Why didn't the antioxidants work?
So there's really two questions in your question, and that has to do is the harmful effects that high-dose vitamin E may engender in a normal person. That's one issue. The second issue is in the clinical trials of people with Alzheimer's or even mild cognitive impairment, why has vitamin E not been successful? And in my mind, there are several possibilities for this. One is that in the case of Alzheimer's people, it's already too late. And in fact, even with MCI, it may be already too late. People now understand that pathology exists at least 20 years prior to symptoms. So it is really important to maintain a high antioxidant diet to stay cognitively active, that is to say, stimulate your brain to make new synapses, learn a new language, play a new instrument, solve the New York Times crossword puzzles, whatever it takes, and to exercise. To the extent that one can, I recognize that some people can't. But those three things we showed in a higher mammal were able to basically make an old dog brain look like a very young dog brain. And our colleagues had shown that that kind of treatment, high antioxidant diet, intellectual stimulation, and exercise were able to lead to behavior of a 15-year-old beagle to act like a 4-year-old beagle in terms of memory and function tests.
This is the beagle experiment that I've heard so much about. You got these aged beagles. Now, Rick, I can relate to an aged beagle.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But I'm just sitting there thinking, going, I don't know if I want my beagle to be 4 all the time.
Well, but the thing is, this beagle, I mean,
it chews everything in your house.
No, I understand, but, you know, I mean, I wouldn't mind being half my age or mentally. Well,
me
maybe
too.
Maybe I would. I don't know. Alan, let's think about this. I mean, I've got to stop you. I've just got to stop you because you're going to make people half their age, and this sounds awful. No, but going back to it then, I understand, so you eat this diet that is high in antioxidants, in natural antioxidants. You stimulate because you want to make as many connections as you can. You're going to lose them no matter what.
No kidding.
Now, what is physical exercise? How do you feel that does?
There's quite a lot of research going on now, so the answers that I give now are just preliminary for what we see. But basically, when one does vigorous exercise, one sees an elevation of brain-derived nerve growth factor, and that coats neurons and protects them and allows them to live longer. So I'm sure other reasons for the why exercise works, but that in early studies is one of the prominent ones.
We'll talk more about amyloid beta, about Alzheimer's disease, and maybe about aged beagles, because that sure struck a nerve here, at least with the studio audience. In our third and final fractional portion, you're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Dr. Alan Butterfield Show because, from the University of Kentucky, the Alumni Association Endowed Professor of Biological Chemistry and the Director of the Center of Membrane Sciences joins us, Dr. Alan Butterfield. Welcome back, Alan.
Thank you.
Our sponsor for the last time, top 10 fun facts about Alzheimer's disease. Number one, identified more than 100 years ago by Dr. Alzheimer, who noticed both the amyloid plaques, and amyloid is the thing we're talking about, not necessarily the plaques, and the neurofibrillary tangles in a sample of this woman patient's brain. Fun fact number two, sixth leading cause of death in American adults. Number three, Kentucky has 80,000 people with Alzheimer's disease or had that in 2010. Number four, one in eight people age 65 and older, and half the people over age 85 have Alzheimer's disease. Number five, age is the primary risk factor. The rates double every 5 years in people over age 65. Six, it's unusual to occur before age 60, but 4% of those are under age 65. Number seven, one in three seniors dies with it or another type of dementia. Number eight, two-thirds of Americans with Alzheimer's are women, simply because women, in this case, are not as stupid and live longer than men. Number nine, people with the disease survive, on average, half as long as similarly aged adults without it. And number 10, in 2012, $216 billion worth of unpaid care came from the families of people with Alzheimer's disease. Again, a devastating disease both for the patient and for the family. Now, before we go on, I introduced again Dr. Butterfield as the Alumni Association Endowed Professor of Biological Chemistry. But the way he came to my attention, and Rick, I have a very limited attention span. You know that. Thanks. And the way he came to their attention was actually back last July, the Society for Free Radical Biology. And wouldn't that be a great – wouldn't you want to be a part of that? This is, you mentioned the free radicals. It sounds like a rough group. I imagine there's eye patches and, you know, lots of alcohol. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. You know, free – I mean, you could – you never know. It could be the other way, too. They could be, you know, tree huggers or, you know,
Biology and medicine. They named Dr. Butterfield as the 2013 Discovery Award recipient. It's given out every other year to a researcher who has presented significant advancements in the field of redox research. The recipients must be nominated, and obviously you were. There were eight candidates nominated. You were recognized for your role as a pioneer in developing and investigating the model of amyloid beta-induced early oxidative stress, which is what we've been talking about. So what we're talking about on this program, admittedly, this is not an award-winning show, but this is award-winning research on the show.
It's as close as we can get,
yeah,
Tony.
That's about the best we can do. So tell us about the award. What do you get, $1 million and your own jet plane or what?
Oh, wouldn't that be nice? No, I get to discuss in 30 minutes the basis for the award, that is to say the free radical story in Alzheimer's disease and also the free radical basis of chemotherapy-induced cognitive impairment, or the patients call chemo brain, and the discovery of redox proteomics that we made.
Let's talk about that for a moment, about chemo brain, because this is a very hot topic. It turns out that there are people, particularly women who get chemotherapy for breast cancer, seem to have a lasting effect from the chemotherapy called chemo brain. And it looks, for all the world, and its effects, like Alzheimer's disease.
Well, not quite Alzheimer's, but it does affect executive thinking and multitasking. There's a lot of confusion. And a good example is a friend of mine who called me, had been diagnosed with this condition, who was a student at the theological school here in Lexington, and she was able to normally write a term paper of some sort in a few hours, found it was taking her a few weeks to do because it just took her so long to concentrate on the particular subject. So this is a pretty serious disorder, and we were able to find the mechanism by which this happens. We're absolutely convinced of it, and in January, have all of your listeners cross their fingers because we'll be submitting an NIH proposal to the National Cancer Institute to receive funding to carry this through all the way to flesh this out once and for all.
Can you give us kind of a preview? What do you think causes chemotherapy? I assume that it's probably free radicals, I'm guessing.
That is so, but indirectly. So what happens is the chemotherapy agent itself does not get into the brain, but it induces in the periphery, in the plasma, an elevation of a cytokine called TNF-alpha that does get into brain. And when it elevates in brain, it leads to a series of biochemical effects that lead to neuronal death. When enough neurons have died, you start to see the cognitive process happen. Every step of the mechanism involved in this, we have fleshed out, and it appears to be that this mechanism is correct. And we will go forward to the NCI to now test a molecule that seems to prevent this process, at least in animals, and we hope eventually in people as well.
Do you think, is this due to certain types of chemotherapy, or do you think anyone who gets chemotherapy would have this TNF problem?
What a very good question, Tony. It turns out that 50% of all FDA-approved chemotherapy agents produce free radicals. So if one is being treated by any of those molecules, our presumption is that the same kind of mechanism will occur. We have demonstrated this to be the case in two such drugs, one doxorubicin and the other Taxol.
Okay, so, Rick, add this to your list. You're going to exercise. You're going to eat Mediterranean-type diet with lots of fruits, nuts, and antioxidants. You're going to read and stimulate your brain, and you're going to avoid getting a cancer that requires certain types of chemotherapy.
Who are you talking to?
Yeah. So keep that in mind as we think going forward.
I'll do it if you will.
Yeah. I'm interested in avoiding chemotherapy, but I have family experience with a person who had breast cancer and had a significant change in cognition afterwards. So I was very interested when I heard that you were thinking about that. One more thing I want to ask you about and maybe add to our list of things to do is get enough sleep. And this, again, was the October issue of Science about perhaps sleep causing a reduction in amyloid levels. How would that work?
You know, I think this was a wonderful study by folks at Washington University of St. Louis, mostly. And I think the molecular mechanisms for this are still speculative. So it's not quite clear. But the effect seems real. And so I really would second your admonition to your listeners. Really do get a sufficient amount of sleep, because if you don't, your body will respond. And one of the potentially harmful ways is to upregulate the amount of amyloid beta peptide.
You know, Rick, I get a summary of important scientific findings in comic book form from the internet. And what they say, and this is during sleep, the brain undergoes physical changes that allows the drainage system to work faster. Brain cells, this says, shrink by 60% during sleep, which is, you may have noticed, when I wake up in the morning, I blow into my thumb.
I don't see you when you wake up in the morning.
Probably not. I guess you weren't aware of that. But at any rate,
I just wanted their listeners to understand that. Yeah, but you kind of left it kind of gray there.
Yeah, I understand. apparently, you're just not going to go along with it. That's fine. But the idea then that there is, you know, we've asked, why do people sleep in the first place? Why do we need that sleep? And this may be a very important benefit of sleep. Now, flipping that around as well, there is a phenomenon called sundowning in people with Alzheimer's disease where the symptoms get worse at the end of the day. Now, I'd seen that maybe linked to melatonin, but right. It might also be that it's time to clean your brain a little bit.
Absolutely. Most people think the melatonin at night, and you have to be in a dark room, right? Any kind of light is like having your pineal gland out. But if you have the melatonin being secreted by the pineal gland during sleep, it's alleged by good studies to clean out the detritus of the day in your brain and allow you to then the next day function better. And indeed, if the lack of sleep means the lack of melatonin release from the pineal gland, that certainly could contribute to amyloid beta peptides damage.
So once again, our top tips to avoid Alzheimer's disease: 1, regular exercise; 2, a diet rich in fruits, nuts, what they call Mediterranean diet, which includes fish as the main meat protein. As a matter of fact, processed meats are just, you might as well just go ahead and sign up for an Alzheimer's study if you're going to be eating those processed meats. If your meat comes in a geometric shape, you are headed for Alzheimer's disease, in our opinion. 3, mental activity to try to create as many synapses as you can. 4, avoid cancers, particularly those types with certain types of chemotherapy that will generate these free radical oxidants that we're talking about. And 5, get enough sleep at night.
Can somebody finally say, what is enough sleep? Is 5 hours enough?
Probably not.
Is 6 hours enough?
I mean, I think you're starting. I remember there were these guys, and I know you saw them at Duke as well, and there were these incredible guys who got by on 4 hours sleep. I remember when Rick Pitino was at UK. He would have basketball practice at 4
I get
in the morning.
By on 5 hours. Is that enough is what I'm asking.
Yeah. I don't think so. I mean, I can already see it. You're definitely slowing down.
And you don't see me when I wake up in the morning.
Yeah, it's true.
Make that clear, Tony.
Do the blowing on the thumb thing and inflate your brain before you come to work, for goodness sakes. But seriously, they're talking about 7 to 9. You go over 9, you're in trouble. You start dropping down 6 and 5, and you start to get in trouble. And again, it's a range. It's not like there's an on-off switch for your amyloid protein and your drainage system. But that's the numbers that I'm seeing.
I can't remember the last time I got 7 hours of sleep on a weeknight.
Well, that just doesn't exist. Yeah, I understand. Now, the other thing, Alan, I wanted to ask you about, there's two possible causes of Alzheimer's disease, or there's many, but there are two main things we're looking at. One is the amyloid. The other is the tau protein that forms these neurofibrillary tangles. And this from the New York Times back a year ago, talking about that, said, well, the tau protein explains how it would spread from one nerve cell to another. Is there a similar explanation you can get using amyloid?
Actually, there is. You can actually seed further aggregation by having an initial aggregation state. So as one set of amyloid aggregates is formed, nearby monomeric A-beta can then be induced to join that or form its own aggregate. So, yeah, that is a problem. The tau protein is kind of an interesting story. So the normal role of tau is to stabilize the railroad track of microtubules in axons and allow them to carry cargo down to the synapse from the cell body and back. And when tau has too much phosphate groups on it, as in the case of Alzheimer's, it falls off the railroad tracks and makes the railroad tracks fall apart, starving the synapse for its energy in the form of ATP and therefore causing it to die. So tau is in many ways an executioner that is a consequence of the damage initiated by the amyloid beta peptide.
So we've got, again, we've got these two groups that believe that tau is the main protein. Is that right, Alan?
Yes.
But in your opinion, the amyloid beta, the main thing, tau, the executioner, the train wreck, if you will, finishes off the nerve after the oxidative damage is done.
I say now the so-called Taoists becoming fewer and fewer in number. Most people who are involved in Alzheimer's research and therapy believe that the amyloid beta peptide oligomers are the toxic species for this disease.
That's got to be satisfying.
To know what you're dealing with.
Yeah, you've spent this long, and I will say again, the idea of pursuing something as long as you have. Rick, we've said it before earlier in the show. I've had things that I thought were important, things that I thought this is an important idea I just had, or I call them a hypophany. You know, I don't really have epiphanies. I'm not that smart, but I can at least have a hypophany. And these little ideas, and I think I should go do this. And for a week or so, I'm fully dedicated to trying to make that happen. And then either it does or doesn't, and I go on and have another idea.
So how'd you manage to keep this show going 10 years?
Well, every week I have a different idea. That's fairly simple. But if you take one thing and you spend your career working on it, and then you start to see these awards start to rack up, and you start to see the entire scientific world shifting to your idea. This is the guy that's in the studio with us.
Steady stuff.
I don't know what that feels like, but it's got to be a real...
I haven't seen any radio shows adopt our process.
No, we're... best we can tell, we're not shifting much of anything other than our own weight. But still, I'll tell you, that's just surprising. Not surprising, I guess, but certainly gratifying knowing that happened. You know, we got a little bit of time left, and I really wanted to broach this. You have seen, I'm sure, over your career, ebbs and flows in the funding for scientific research. Talk to us a little bit now about what you're seeing as economic times are tightening and how that affects your ability to move forward with your work.
Oh, this is such an important point. The sequester has been so damaging to the NIH, and a second round of sequester is scheduled early in 2014. It's going to be devastating. If this continues unabated, the $30-plus billion budget of NIH is going to drop, it's predicted, to $19 billion. Can you imagine what that would do to fundamental research? When you have to lay off the people who've been in your lab for as long as many labs have these technical people working for them, you lose the institutional memory of all the things you know how to do. And so even if you were lucky enough to get a new grant funded under this diminished funding environment, you'd have to start all over again, training people how to do the basic experiments. It's really devastating for work. And yet, if you were to fund biomedical research, think about this as a jobs program, because you're going to hire really talented people who are going to spend the money locally, thereby increasing the economy of that environment. And if one is fortunate, we're going to find things that are going to help the health of Americans to live longer in a more healthy way.
And that's the balance we've got. On the one hand, we obviously don't have the funding to be the world's policeman. Perhaps some people argue not the funding to have the world's preeminent research centers, but you cannot turn the switch off and simply turn it back on in better economic times. This dismantling can be a big issue. I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Alan Butterfield, the Alumni Association Endowed Professor of Biological Chemistry and the Director of the Center of Membrane Sciences at the University of Kentucky. Rick, can you get us out of here?
Special thanks to WUKY Operations and Programming Manager John Lamagi, Morehead State Public Radio producer Asa Hasoda, to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
for short periods of time, Health Matters is generally considered safe at doses up to the recommended tolerable upper level. However, Health Matters is possibly unsafe when used at doses exceeding the tolerable upper level.
Possibly unsafe when exceeding the The recommended daily allowance of Health Matters obtained through weekend consumption is considered to be safe and beneficial.
Evidence suggests that regular listening to high-dose Health Matters may increase the risk of death from all causes by a small amount. These conclusions have been criticized by some experts. Nonetheless, this is the best scientific evidence currently available.
Chronic listening to Health Matters should be done cautiously, and high-dose Health Matters should be avoided. Acute overdose of Health Matters is very uncommon.
In rare cases, Health Matters has been associated with dizziness, fatigue, headache, blurred vision, abdominal pain, diarrhea, and flu-like symptoms.
Patients with cardiovascular conditions should listen cautiously. Health Matters may increase the risk of all-cause mortality and the incidence of heart failure.
Patients with Alzheimer's disease or cognitive decline should also listen cautiously. In patients with Alzheimer's disease or cognitive decline, Health Matters has been associated with an increase in falls and fainting.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for our exciting series on the health benefits of procrastination on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.